A round of boos, leaked emails, and high-profile resignations. Also, a call for party unity. Just ahead, a look at the Democrats' hopes for beating Donald Trump as their national convention continues. Good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, and watch the show with video on demand at our partner, TVJax.com. Just ahead, we'll take your calls on the fractious first day of the Democratic National Convention as District 4 Congressional candidate David Bruderle offers his thoughts. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, Jacksonville Magazine is calling all writers. Show off your fiction skills. We'll tell you about their contest. Plus, a cultural institution at the beaches celebrates 25 years of entertainment. All of that ahead. But first, this hour, the Democratic National Convention heads into day two today in Philadelphia. After a series of rousing speeches last night designed to unify the party after a fractious opening day, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders closed out the convention's first night with a forceful plea for his supporters to get behind nominee Hillary Clinton. This after he was booed by his supporters earlier in the day. Can the Democrats unite behind the common goal of beating Donald Trump? This morning, we discuss it with Sanders supporter and District 4 candidate for Congress here in Jacksonville, David Bruderle. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on the show, Melissa.
And to our callers, let us know your thoughts as the Democrats' convention continues in Philadelphia. Where do you stand? Do you think the party will unify as the Dems have their own issues with unifying, just as the Republicans did in Cleveland? Get on the line now, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show or weigh in on our Facebook page. David Bruderle, you are the only Democrat in the District 4 race for Congress as Andrew Crenshaw has announced his retirement. You have been a vocal Bernie Sanders supporter from day one. You're modeling your campaign on the Sanders style of small donations rather than big fundraisers. Your thoughts about last night's convention speeches, which capped off with Sanders asking his supporters on the floor to unify behind the Hillary Clinton-Tim Kaine ticket?
Well, I think that Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey really set up the evening with a very passionate speech about democratic values and how this country needs to get back to some of the people first type of values that Democrats have governed with for many, many years. And then Michelle Obama came in and gave an extremely passionate speech talking about, again, those values and how they relate to the average person. But Bernie nailed it. I mean, Bernie came out and he gave not only an endorsement for Hillary, but he explained to people why it was important for them to come together to support not just her, but to support the revolution that he says he's leading. And he made the commitment that he is going to continue fighting for the platform that he'd advocated, and that he's going to do everything he can to make it happen. And I want to make the point, and Bernie made this point in his speech, all the emphasis in the national media and even the local media is on the president race, but it's the United States Congress, the Senate, and the United States House of Representatives that, in my opinion, are the real problem in this country. You know, we've had the Republicans in control of the U.S. House for 18 of the last 22 years. And when Newt Gingrich became Speaker in 1984, he put a policy in place that was called Kill the Beast. If they didn't have enough support to deauthorize a program they didn't like, mostly social programs, they would kill the funding. And they have created this whole concept, this anti-government, I don't know what to call it, hysteria about how government is bad, government is bad. You know, Ronald Reagan started it, and a lot of improvements have been made, but they've taken it over the top. They've taken it to the point where the Republican Party has become the problem, in my judgment.
In your opinion.
In my opinion. Because the executive, the president, his job is to execute the laws of the land to the best of his ability, but he's constrained by the Congress. He's constrained by the budget that the Congress appropriates, and he's constrained by what he can do within the law. And this, all these arguments about executive overreach and everything else are simply, in my judgment, the president trying to execute the laws, a lot of them which were written, like in the environmental area, back in the 1970s. And he's merely trying to implement those laws, which have been not enforced the way they were intended when they were written for 40 years.
And if you're just tuning in, we'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Speaking of budgeting, you're the only Democrat in the District 4 race for Congress. The seat opening when Andrew Crenshaw, to many surprise, announced his retirement. On the Republican side, it's a crowded field. We've already hosted State Representative Lake Ray. We will host two of the other top-tier candidates, former Sheriff John Rutherford and Hans Tansler III, in the coming weeks. Let me ask you, this is a heavily Republican district. The Republican is certainly favored to win. You dipped into your own campaign account to qualify as the sole Democrat on the ballot in this race.
Right.
Is this a fool's errand?
Well, it's a uphill fight, but it's not a fool's errand, because if I had not filed to run 5 minutes before the deadline on Friday, June 24th, there would have been a closed primary, and 60% of the voters in District 4 would have been disenfranchised. They would not have been able to vote for their representative in Congress, the guys who declare war and set the budget. 60%. The Republican dominance in this community is so strong that within a couple weeks of Andrew announcing his retirement, which caught me by surprise, I didn't expect it, the two leading contenders raised, I think, over about $800,000 between the two of them in a matter of a couple weeks. That is a phenomenal fundraising capability, and it shows you that there is very good planning, very good coordination, very good management within the Republican Party of Florida, and specifically here in Jacksonville, to allow people to do that. But, you know, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. They raised so much money that basically Democrats were scared off. And Jay McGovern is now, he decided not to run in this district. He went down south into the St. Johns County, where he's going to have a competition between three other Democrats in a primary. And then the whole District 5 fiasco is another whole other story. But I basically filed to have democracy in action here in Jacksonville. If I had not filed, 60% of the voters would not have been able to vote in this election for their representative in Congress.
And let's talk about your issues in this campaign. You are an adherent of the top issues that animated Bernie Sanders' campaign, in particular income inequality, also a commitment to raising awareness about environmental issues. What would you say to those listening who are animated by other issues, in particular fear of terrorism, which we saw a lot about at the Republican convention? There will also be, I think it's fair to say, a strong push by those who simply dislike Hillary Clinton to come out and vote, not so much voting for Donald Trump, but against Hillary Clinton.
Well, I would not have been able to run if I had not run back in 2002. And I ran in 2002 because I asked my congressman at that time what he was going to do about the invasion of Iraq. And the answer I got was, I'm going to rubber stamp what the president is going to do. He's the commander-in-chief. My response to him was, you're a congressman. Congress declares war. The executive does not go to war by himself. And yet that is exactly what happened. So I ran for Congress to try to have that debate. And I will tell you that I ran 2002, 4, and 6, and the issues that I was talking about in 2002, 4, and 6 are the same issues that Bernie was talking about today, with very few exceptions. We broke Iraq, and Iraq occupation and the Iraqi fiasco is the spawning ground for all the problems that we now have in the Middle East. And you got to have responsible leadership in the Congress. You got to have people who are willing to stand up to the executive and ask tough questions before you rubber stamp what the executive wants to do. I don't care whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. That's the duty of Congress, and Congress did not do that.
And that includes Democrats. Most Democrats signed
absolutely off
as well. What would you
say? No. 130-some Democrats voted no on the October resolution in 2002. Only one Republican voted no, and he got voted out of office the next year.
Let's talk about the Democratic Party's rocky opening to the convention, as emails that apparently were hacked by Russian cyber specialists have revealed that now ousted party chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz seemed to be putting her thumb on the scale for Hillary Clinton. That greatly angered Bernie Sanders supporters. Your thoughts about that?
Well, I don't know what the Russians did, but it's very likely if they did that, they're meddling in our election for their own nefarious purposes, I guess because Donald's in love with Putin or something like that, you know.
He denies that.
Okay, well, basically, it doesn't surprise me. Bernie was an independent. Even though he caucused with the Democrats, he was an independent. And there are a lot of people in the Democrat establishment who kind of felt like he was an outsider and was taking over their party. I say good for them, but the Democrats have the same problem Republicans do. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's that simple.
How will you reassure those who might be looking at your candidacy that you wouldn't become corrupted if Mr. Bruderle goes to Washington? I mean, that's the type of campaign you're running.
Right.
You don't have the apparatus that the high-profile Republicans will certainly be bringing to the table in terms of fundraising, awareness, party support. The Republican apparatus in this area is much stronger, I think it's fair to say, than the local Democratic Party.
A lot of my good friends are Republicans, and I know how to work with people from all stripes. I'm a professional engineer. I'm not a professional politician, and I am running because I want to have issues discussed based on facts and rational, logical analysis of those facts, including the application of the principles of science when it comes to issues like climate change. How do you clean up the pollution and the water in this community, in the St. John's River, the Everglades? How do you prevent problems from happening? You know, I started my career as a professional consulting engineer working with industry. We helped build the sub-base, bring the sub-base up at Kings Bay to Florida, to Georgia. Created lots of jobs in this community. Helped build some power plants back in the 70s and the 80s by getting environmental permits and doing it in the most responsible way possible. But in 1990, I was part of the Reynolds, Smith & Hills family company companies. I was in environmental science and engineering in Gainesville. And in 1990, when that company was destroyed by a vulture capitalist, I got my freedom.
And how was it destroyed?
Well, the guy did Ivan Boesky, a leveraged buyout. He basically borrowed money against our real estate assets and bought the company, and we owned the buildings and everything else. Those buildings are now owned by somebody else, and the Reynolds, Smith & Hills that exists today is a phoenix that arose from the ashes. And ESE component is now part of a multinational big conglomerate. It doesn't exist anymore the way it used to. But my point is, when I got my freedom, I looked at my career had been built on working with the establishment, working with the regulations, trying to make them better and do the best job we could for our clients. And also was built on cleaning up the mess that had been created because we didn't have these environmental laws in place 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago. It did quite well. In 1990, I shifted my focus to how do you prevent pollution? How do you prevent problems? And that has guided my career for the last 26 years, and has taken me not just in the field of environmental, but in the field of job creation. How do you build a 21st century economy for the United States, for Jacksonville, Florida? Do you continue making the same mistakes we made in the past? Albert Einstein tells us that's insanity. If you do the same thing over and over again, you're not going to get different results. We need to take advantage of our intellect and our capital and our labor pool, train our kids so they can compete in a 21st century economy. But more important, we've got to train our politicians and our leaders to be willing to compete in a 21st century economy. And it is a global economy by using the resources that we have wisely and using the technology that we control to create new jobs. Zero net energy home construction, for example, is technically feasible. Zero emission electric cars are technically feasible, and they perform just as well as a gasoline. Look at the Tesla vehicle. You know, going self-driving is a distraction from the fundamental issue is how do you break the oil addiction? You know, we went into Iraq because of oil, and we're still bogged down there 26 years later because we have not been an honest mediator of peace in the Middle East because our perceptions have been biased by our short-term economic interests, and we have to change that.
And if you're just tuning in, as we speak with congressional candidate for District 4, Democrat David Bruderle right now, we want your thoughts and questions for him and your thoughts about the Democratic National Convention and the road ahead to 2016. Who will get your vote on November 8th? Give us a call right now, 549-2937, to join the program. John is downtown. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Good to be here.
Hey, go ahead.
So I worked with the Clinton campaign during the primaries here in Jacksonville, And I mean, I think when we talk about, you know, the chaos of the DNC, we have to realize that 85% of Bernie supporters have already said that they will vote for Clinton in a Clinton versus Trump case. So I think what we're seeing is a very select group of very vocal Bernie supporters who are delegates. So I don't think it's a national trend.
And so you think that the Bernie Sanders wing of the party will come home to Hillary Clinton's candidacy on November 8th? You don't think they'll sit it out? You don't think they'll vote for Donald Trump or not vote?
I mean, I think we saw this in 08 with the Pumas, how, you know, the Clinton supporters said they weren't going to embrace Obama, and then they did. I think this happens when there's a very divisive primary. We know we've seen this in the past, but I think in general, they usually will come over. I think they won't. I think for them to vote for Trump would be an ideological 180. I could see some of them voting for Jill Stein, but I don't think she has the name recognition to win.
Okay. Thanks, John. Thanks for calling. And Jill Stein is with the Green Party, the candidate for the Green Party. David Bruderle, yesterday on Twitter and in a speech, Donald Trump tried to make an appeal to disgruntled Bernie Sanders supporters, saying that they had been robbed, they had been mistreated, and that they should consider him. What are your thoughts about the way both Trump and Sanders, in very different manners, of course, have tapped into this anger and disaffection across the country on both ends of the spectrum?
Well, Bernie has talked about issues and solutions to some very entrenched problems like illegal immigration, economic development, sustainable economic development, health care for everybody, affordable health care for everybody. Trump calls people names. He divides. You know, the divider in this particular race is not Hillary Clinton. The divider in this race is Donald Trump at the presidential level. And I'm not going to go there. I want to have a congenial talk with my opponent, whoever wins the Republican primary, and talk and challenge them to give me solutions. And I know some of these guys. I've known Lake Ray for a long time. He's an engineer like me.
He's an engineer like you.
Yeah. We worked on the Clean Cities program. I worked with him to help bring some of the policy in place that would bring these natural gas vehicles and locomotives to this community. I want to build on that type of cooperation across the aisle. I'm not going to go down and start calling people names. But I am going to point out that absolute power corrupts absolutely. And Donald Trump is a personification of that type of mentality. He said, I alone can solve these problems. You know, I was talking to a fellow the other day who was a Republican, and he said, you know, look at his body language. He looks like Mussolini. I mean, that is not what this country needs. This country needs a leader who people can look up to and respect.
What would you say to those who look at Hillary Clinton's candidacy, controversy over her email server and other issues, and don't feel that she is honest and trustworthy?
I think Hillary has admitted that she made some mistakes with that, a serious mistake with the email server, but she also pointed out that the State Department made a lot of those mistakes with previous secretaries having similar kinds of systems. The facts are that she's been in the spotlight since her husband became president, and she has been under a microscope, and she's very defensive. And I can understand why she has this need to kind of look at the Monica Lewinsky thing. She wants to keep her personal life and her kids out of the public spotlight. And I think that's what she was trying to do. The stuff about all the other stuff she's into that goes back into Whitewater and all that other stuff, that's all been thoroughly investigated, and nothing. Benghazi has had, what, how many, 9 hearings? She takes responsibility because she was Secretary of State, but she didn't cause those people to get killed. The ambassador in Libya was a personal friend of hers. You know, so I think a lot of this criticism that has been blasted at her, you know, is totally unfair and uncalled for.
Let's go to Richard on the South Side. Go ahead, Richard, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to make 2 quick points. First of all, I disagree that you have to talk issues with the American people. After watching Trump's campaign, I don't think they're interested in issues because most of them don't know the issues. And the rest of the thing, they want to show, and they want you to tell the negatives. And I know that this is not what your guest says, but I think that she had to stay on this point. That's number one. Number two, all the things about Russia interfering and people saying, oh, that's silly and it's not anything that's serious. Let me tell you, when Trump speaks against NATO, Putin is licking his chops, and he will do anything he can to weaken NATO. And Trump is that man. And it wouldn't surprise me a bit because of the timing and because of who's sitting over there in exile to this thing being true. They're trying to manipulate our election. That's all I got to say.
Okay, thanks, Richard. Researchers looking into the DNC hack have determined that, in their view, it is the responsibility of operatives in Russia. What about his comments?
I totally agree that, I'm a military guy. I went to the United States Merchant Academy. I earned an appointment from my congressman back in the 60s during the Vietnam era, and I was a naval officer. And we do not back away from our obligations, our commitments, treaty commitments, and whether it's CETO or NATO or any other commitment around the world. I believe in American exceptionalism. And for Trump to come out and question our commitment to our allies in Northern Europe, to me, is un-American.
What about his argument that we're dealing with a different terrain today, a patchwork of cells and lone wolf terrorists that can arise very unexpectedly and randomly, and that we need a different framework?
It's a police action. It's, you know, we got this whole problem of how do you define your enemy, you know, and some people want to call it Islamic terrorism and mix religion into it. It is violence. It is terrorism. It is criminal behavior. And if we really wanted, for example, to take out Saddam Hussein because he was a mass murderer, we could have used the International Criminal Court and taken him out the same way we took out Slobodan Milosevic in Yugoslavia. Instead, we mobilized the United States military to occupy a country. We use sledgehammers to pound nails. We should be using the right tool for the job. And international terrorism is turning into an international policing operation where you identify the people who are promoting the terrorism, and you go find them and you take care of them in a way that's legal.
Let's go to Jerry in Jacksonville. Hi, Jerry. Thanks for holding. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey.
I am a refugee from Cuba. Came over in 1962.
Oh,
and
wow.
For different reasons, have been a lifelong Republican. I couldn't wait to get my citizenship so I could vote.
Uh-huh.
And have been, like, you know, mostly Republican all my life. But right now, I am so frustrated and disappointed in that party, and beyond disgusted with the Republican candidate. And I just cannot conceive this happening in a country that I love so much. However, I have to comment that he tapped into the general discontent with the politics that are going on, where, as you know, since the very first constitutional convention in this country, when you have opposing views, but, you know, things got worked out, there have been, you know, issues that have been propelling propelling the country forward. But now there's name calling, total polarizing, and nothing's getting done. How does your guest feel about this?
Yeah, and let me ask you, as a lifelong Republican and a refugee from Cuba, Cubans in Florida generally have voted Republican over the years. That's changing somewhat. Who will get your vote this fall?
Not the Republican.
Who will? Will it be the Libertarian? Will it be the Democrat? Who will you vote for?
You know, my vote will be by conscience. I may vote for Hillary. I really, really wish, because Americans in general are a forgiving nation, if you will, that she would say, I have made mistakes, but these are my qualifications, and you owe it to yourselves not to let someone totally ignorant of issues, totally inappropriate, totally, I don't know how to describe it, to be the head of the greatest country in the world.
All right.
And if she would just admit that, everything would be different for her, in my estimation, anyway.
Okay.
So, I may vote for her if something like that may happen, but definitely not Republican.
Okay, thanks, Jerry. Jerry in Jacksonville, refugee from Cuba. David Bruderle, what about his comments in particular? And I know you want to talk about your campaign, but what about his comments that Hillary Clinton needs to do a better job of, I guess, being transparent, in his view, with undecided voters?
She's been pretty transparent in taking responsibility for the things that she's been accused of failing on, whether it's Libya, whether it's Benghazi, whether it's her email server. I don't know how many times I've been watching the nightly news and saw her say, I made a mistake. I'm sorry. I apologize. So what do they want, an ounce of flesh or a pound of flesh? Or I don't know. But the problem with nothing getting done is that we have a do-nothing Congress. I go back to my point. 18 of the last 22 years, we've had a House of Representatives controlled by the Republican Party. Democrats have been in charge of the House for only 4 of those 22 years. When the Democrats were in charge, they made a mistake. They took their power and they pushed through the Affordable Care Act and gave the With no Republican votes. And the Republicans say this was railroaded. But the Democrats did that because in 1994, Gingrich came to power because Hillary was in charge of trying to create reform health care in the early 90s. She really stepped on a lot of toes, and she failed miserably. So the Democrats saw the opportunity, and they took it because they realized that they had to do something. And the Republicans had done nothing about immigration. When I ran in 2002, I tried to debate my opponent face-to-face. He would not debate me in 3 campaigns. He never showed up for a candidate forum, never in public. They did not want to talk about immigration. We had 5,000 illegal immigrants in Ocala working on the horse farms that showed up on a Cinco de Mayo celebration. I was astounded. I didn't know that was a problem in 2002, 2004. The Republicans know about these problems, but they don't want to talk about it because they can keep their base happy and mobilized to win power through re-elections.
Let me ask you, in this campaign, the Republican standard bearer is talking about it just in a very different way. He's saying we're going to halt all immigration and build a wall on the southern border to keep out any further illegal immigrants. So he has spoken in plain language in a way that, of course, many see as divisive and wrongheaded. But he's talking about it.
How successful was the Berlin Wall? How successful was the Iron Curtain? Walls fail. Walls do not work. The Israelis are building walls. It's not working. There's no peace in that part of the world. You cannot build walls. What you have to do is build bridges. And then you have to work out the economic and social and violence problems that are driving people across the border to come here. Lately, because they haven't been coming here because the Mexican economy is picking up. But you've got violence in Central America, in Cuba. We've got Cubans who live here legally because they got special treatment. What's the difference between a Cuban and a Guatemalan? If you're fleeing a drug cartel in Guatemala, why shouldn't you be given the same treatment as...
Lots of calls, meanwhile, for District 4 congressional candidate David Bruderle as we continue to talk about the Democrats' convention in Philadelphia, following on our coverage of the Republican convention in Cleveland. Let's go to Ira on the South Side. Hi, Ira. Good morning.
Thanks, Melissa. Very important show. 2 points. One, I hope the gentleman, when he's elected, will get the Merchant Marines added as one of the uniform services for their brave and heroic service to our country. They're not currently a part of the 7 uniform services of the military, so I hope he has success in adding them. Second, Melissa, arguably you are the most important journalist in the Jacksonville area. Is there any way...
I don't know about that, Ira, but thank you very much.
I'm absolutely convinced. But after the primary election, is there any way that you and other important journalists can arrange a number of open, sunshine, to the public debates between your guest and whoever the Republican nominee is? Maybe 6 or 7 public debates around the city. Can you use your influence to do that?
I'll tell you what I can do. I can continue to host all of the candidates right here on this program, and I can make the pitch for other community groups to host those forums around town. You see them. Menonac is hosting forums and other groups. And I moderate some of those forums. I'll be moderating a state attorney forum with Menonac in a few weeks. So, yeah, I mean, there will be platforms like that. It's my hope for these candidates.
Yeah, News for Jax is currently working with Jacksonville University to try to have a debate in about 2 weeks of the
for the congressional
for
district
the two
four?
Districts, but only for the people who have primary opponents. My point on his, and I appreciate.
Does that mean you won't be on the debate stage?
Well, I'm arguing to be on the debate stage with the other Republicans, and likewise in District 5, that the Republican be on the debate stage with three Democrats.
With Crean Brown and Al Lawson.
And Holloway, the three Democrats. There's no, given the short election cycle, we don't have 6 months to debate this stuff. And the more exposure any candidate gets in the media, that's automatic. That translates into votes. Any professional campaigner will tell you that. And the way that you had Mike Bender on your show, and I called in because I objected to the fact that he did a poll about a horse race. They look at this whole thing as a horse race. It's a competition. It's I win, you lose. Who's first? And everybody else loses. This is a debate about policy, about issues, and about what is the future of this country, and not about who's got the biggest campaign bankroll. It's about who has the best ideas. And the people don't know what we're talking about because nobody reports about what the Congress does. It's all about the president. It's a horse race. It's a horse race.
Well, to be fair, of course, I am a political junkie, so I look at this stuff all the time. But websites like Politico, Real Clear Politics, and others, they do, thehill.com, mm-hmm. they do cover the Congress, but you have to be sort of already attuned to this stuff to follow it closely.
You have to be really tuned into it. Now, you can go to brutally.com, which is my campaign website, and I have not only my current website there, but I have links to my 2006 campaign, and there's a Quality News Network interview that's on there that's actually in the Library of Congress. People can go to that and see that I've been very consistent in this. I'm not sure.
And let me ask you, David, you've run several times. What would you say to those who would look at your campaign and look at your issues but say, well, he's run several times, he's not going to win. I mean, he's already tried and he hasn't won, and why should I give him my support?
I'm like Hillary. I'm persistent and resilient. I don't give up. My issues were issues, the same issues in 2002, 4, and 6 that I was talking about are the same issues that are on the table today. And the United States Congress, the House in particular, has blocked doing anything to solve those problems. They've been in control for 18 of the last 22 years. We need balance, and we need across the aisle debate.
One more call. It's Tom on the West Side. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, good morning. I have two thoughts on this. One, I got to say I'm truly disappointed with Hillary's vice presidential selection. When Donald Trump has been trying to tar her with the label of crooked for her to choose a vice president with a reputation for taking very generous gifts from people with financial stakes, and his decision is just irresponsible and invites problems from the Republican Party. As for his criticism of the Reagan administration policy that government was bad, I think the best example of how government can overreach it can be found every day in dependency court, where the government brings its full weight against normal families.
Okay,
all
Tom.
Of which, yeah.
All right. Thanks for the call. And as we're running short on time, a couple of comments on our Facebook page. As a Democrat, I don't believe our party is in nearly as much turmoil as the media would have us believe. Trump will lose in a landslide, writes JP. Here's another comment from you on our Facebook page from Janice. Mr. Brutally needs a Facebook page. Just FYI.
He does have a Facebook page. Brutally, numeral 4, Congress.
All righty. Well, thanks for being with us. He's David Brutally, the sole Democrat in the District 4 congressional race. Thanks for joining the show.
Well, thank you, Melissa. I've enjoyed it.
And in the coming days and weeks, we will host two of the other top-tier candidates for District 4, Hans Tansler III and former Sheriff John Rutherford. Much more still ahead later, a cultural institution at the beaches celebrating 25 years this weekend. But up next, how you can show off your fiction writing skills this month in the pages of Jacksonville Magazine. Back in a moment.
Legal and political segments on First Coast Connect, brought to you by Farrah and Farrah.
This week on Invisibilia, we explore the stories of people who faked it till they became it.
I said, well, what if we just created like a fake celebrity entourage and let's just see how many people actually will think I'm famous.
Guys, what was it like meeting Brett?
I love him! But can change happen from the outside in? That's on the next Invisibilia from NPR.
Saturdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
As Florida school districts prepare students for success in a global knowledge-based economy, how does arts education factor into the plan? Join WJCT for Community Thread, The Politics of Arts Education, as we explore this issue and how advocates are working to ensure that diverse perspectives are represented in the development of new arts policies. Log on to wjct.org/communitythread to submit your questions or to RSVP to be a part of our studio audience on August 4th.
This program is underwritten by the Ann McDonald Baker Family Foundation.
The profile of the first-time homebuyer is changing.
They're doing it later, and a lower percentage of them are eventually doing it.
And that could be a big deal for the real estate industry. A report on those changes and what they mean, plus the latest from the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News. Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Forget what the map says. Wall Street isn't just in lower Manhattan anymore. You know, it's in Jersey and Florida and Texas.
The states that are winning financial services jobs are basically sending a message, we appreciate you, we want you, we'll support you.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. That story and today's numbers from Wall Street next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, if you're a budding fiction writer, Jacksonville Magazine wants to see your best work. It's their second annual fiction writing contest, and it's open to all writers living in Northeast Florida. But the deadline's coming up soon. Publisher Joe White is here to tell us all about it, and good to see you.
Good morning. Good to see you.
And this is an exciting opportunity for people. Of course, Jacksonville Magazine is very well known and beloved around town. This is the second year you've done the contest?
Second year we've done this fiction contest, right.
Yeah, and this isn't something you typically see in the pages of the magazine. This is kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, that's the real reason why we set out to do it last year was every now and then we'll get a call, a phone call, an email, a letter, somebody asking, do you submit poetry? Do you run short stories? And typically we don't.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, after years of that, we kind of broke down and said, okay, we'll do it. And had a contest that we started last year. And we do an arts edition in October. And so this just seemed like a nice fit to put in there. So the winner actually appears in that issue in October.
You had so many entries last year. And
yes.
Then you ended up publishing a winning short story and
yes.
A winning poem.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. And so hopefully we'll do that again this year. We'll see what the submissions kind of allow us to do. We want them to be, well done. So we'll see what we get.
How much enthusiasm is there, do you think, for this? Because people don't always have an outlet for their creative writing.
No, particularly for poetry. There's just not a lot of places in print, for sure, that people can have things like that. And also short stories. It's just something that you don't see a lot in print. There's lots of blogs and those kinds of things. But actually having it in print, of course, always makes it a little bit more special. So.
And do you pick the winners, or is there a committee? Or?
Yeah, last year what I did was I got all the submissions, and I took a big box of them home with me over the weekend and just started going through them one at a time. Then I narrowed it down to about 10, and then I had a group of other people say, okay, these are my choices. Select the ones that you think are best from that group. And so we'll probably do something similar again this year.
And the winner gets more than bragging rights, it looks like. They get a prize.
You get bragging rights and some cash.
$500?
$500.
All right.
Yeah. So we actually gave away $500 and $250 last year for a second place. We gave that for the poem entry last year. So we might do that again this year. It really comes down to the quality of the submissions we get. So.
And you want old-fashioned snail mail. You want these submissions to be mailed to you.
Yes. We have to get them in writing. We'll follow up the ones that we select. We'll ask them for an email version or digital copy that we can use for the actual issue. But, you know, it's funny to actually reading these things, poetry and short stories, for whatever reason, it's it's easier and more engaging when you have it in your hand.
Sure.
So I think it's the better way to do it as opposed to just screen after screen after screen. I think that would be hard for me to do. I read a lot already on the screen to do.
Right, right.
To do a couple hundred submissions, short stories is a lot.
That would be hard. And so if you have a short story or a poem that you want to submit to Jacksonville Magazine's second annual fiction writing contest, you only have until the end of the month.
End of the month.
You've got to get this in by July 31st. Just mail your entries to Jacksonville Magazine on King Street. And by the way, Jacksonville Magazine, you and I were talking before we went on the air. It's been through many iterations over the years, but just going strong under your leadership. Pretty exciting to see that.
Yeah, people still read. They still read quality stuff. And in a city like Jacksonville, where it's so large, it's so spread out, it's nice to have a resource where people can see what's happening in different parts of town, whether that be things to do, restaurants, people such as yourself. You know, it's nice to still have that outlet that you can share these stories. And now we can share some fiction stories, too, if we need to.
That's right. So keep those submissions coming to Joe. It's Jacksonville Magazine's second annual fiction writing contest. If you're a writer living in Northeast Florida, you can submit either a short story or a poem. The winning entries will be published in their cultural arts issue in October with a $500 grand prize. So you can't beat that. Good luck, everybody out there. And go to jacksonvillemag.com for contest details.
Yeah, there's a bunch of details on there. So it'll give you everything you need to know.
Joe White, always great to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
Today, we can get just about anything in the grocery store, even in the coldest and most remote places in the U.S.
Do you carry strawberries?
We do carry strawberries.
Even when it's negative 57?
Yes, ma'am.
But what's the price workers pay for the convenience of year-round strawberries? On the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First are proud to present the 4th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire teachers. Saturday, October 8th at the Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Tickets are only $30. Spend the day sharing ideas with colleagues, learning new ways to engage students, and empowering yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
I'm Jackie Carter, Executive Secretary for Duval County's Emergency Operations Center. Have a plan for home, work, and school. Planning can save you valuable time and money in a disaster. Visit jacksready.com for more information and tune to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
This segment is brought to you by Colo CSX Data Center Hosting Solutions.
On the next Jazz Night in America, we've got highlights from the 2015 Newport Jazz Festival, and we toast the 90th birthday of the festival's founder, George Wien.
Look, I'm going to be 90 years old, and I'm still doing what I love. So I guess my survival philosophy is working.
That's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Well, if you're a fan of Instagram, this week we want you to post a beautiful picture and also show us how much you love public radio. It's our I Love WJCT Instagram contest. Every Friday, we will publish our favorite Insta of the week in our newsletter, First Read. This week's theme is all about pets. Have you seen The Secret Life of Pets? It's the top movie at the box office right now. Well, we know you love your pets, and we know you love to take pictures of them. So when you post your pet photo on Instagram, use the hashtag ILoveWJCT, and we will publish the winning photo in our First Read newsletter. Subscribe at WJCTnews.org. Well, finally this hour, it's a celebration of 25 years of children's musical theater at the beaches. This Thursday, ABET, or Atlantic Beach Experimental Theater, is marking its silver anniversary with a special event. Here with Morley Hamby, Jane Bull, and Board President Judy Hewlett. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
And Lee, I tend to think of you as being affiliated with the Five and Dime Theater,
yes.
But this is another animal altogether. Atlantic Beach Experimental Theater has been around, I did not know this, for 25 years. How exciting.
Amazing. They do wonderful work. Yes, I work with the Five and Dime, but I also work with all the other theaters in town as well. And I was very pleased when they called and asked me to direct this benefit for them. So I said yes.
And this is going to be a gala featuring cabaret-type entertainment. Tell
right.
us about it.
Well, actually, the gala is going to be an exhibit at the Beaches Museum. This is featuring all of the memorabilia from YBAG, which was Youth of the Beaches Arts Guild, started in 1980, and we are celebrating our 25th year. Now, YBAG is no longer in existence, but we have 40 alumni coming back to do this cabaret show, and we have all of them will be at the gala to meet everyone there. But it's really exciting, and we can't wait because we're looking at kids that we were involved with from 10 to 18
uh-huh.
and now have children in college.
Oh, very
back.
Nice.
So it's going to be fun.
And when ABET started, this might have been one of the few resources at the beaches for kids to get involved in this kind of creative work. Is that right?
It definitely was. That's what we came up with the idea, Judy and I, that the kids need to know about live theater because we'd always loved the theater ourselves. And so we went to the city and we asked them, would they support us? And they did. The merchants at the beach were wonderful. And the parents were great. I mean, we just had all the support for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just kind of dissolved because things do run out, you
mm-hmm.
know. But it was the time, best of times, for mm-hmm. sure, for
sure.
everyone.
And ABET, I think, has always been cutting edge. I mean, mm-hmm. it stands for Atlantic Beach Experimental Theater. That always catches attention because you're doing stuff that really nobody else is doing
yeah,
on
I mean,
a stage.
There's definitely a mix of that. They do some traditional things as well,
yeah.
but they take some real chances on some plays and musicals.
What have been some examples of that over the years?
Like just recently, I directed a show called Ordinary Days, which is a show that not a lot of people have heard about, but they took a chance on it, and it was a huge success, and we actually took it on the road to a couple of different places. And so I think, you know, they're really good about taking that chance.
And even before Hamilton made a big splash on Broadway, you were casting, ABET was casting roles that were race and gender neutral. That wasn't as mainstream an idea as it is now.
Right.
Exactly.
Like they just cast Macbeth, actually, with a bunch of people that are playing gender neutral roles
uh-huh.
galore. So
what was the reaction like the first time that happened?
Oh, it's, you know, it's
did people's heads explode?
Well, you know, it's amazing, too, because ABET has an older audience most of the time, but I'm so happy being from that generation that they've been accepting
uh-huh. yeah.
and willing. I mean, you always have some, but
right.
this, it's been really interesting, actually.
Right, and so after 25 years of the beaches embracing this whole way of doing live theater. You want everyone to come out to this gala. Give us all the information so people can mark their calendars.
Okay. Well, Thursday, this coming Thursday night is the gala at the Beaches Museum. And then Friday night, the performance will be at Foundation Academy. And Saturday night, the same location.
And as you said, this is a way for everybody to remember the past
exactly.
and look ahead as well.
Exactly. And we're so excited because the museum is allowing us to have the exhibit up for 2 weeks, and they're going to keep part of it in the archives so the other generations, kids who now have kids, who will have kids, will be able to go back and see what their grandmother did,
mm-hmm. Very
our
nice.
Grandfather did. And we're excited that the beach is still supporting us on this.
Very nice. It's Thursday night, Atlantic Beach Experimental Theater's big silver anniversary gala. Get on out and have fun at the gala reception and the cabaret. Lee Hamby, Jane Bull, Board President Julie Hewlett, Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much,
Melissa. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and video on demand segments with our partner, TVJax.com. Next on Die and Ream, it's opening night at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia, how speakers including Senator Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and First Lady Michelle Obama sought to bridge divides and build the case for presumptive nominee Hillary Clinton. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.